American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And now, for Newsreel, here's Sean Kennedy.
And it is a good day. This is Sean Kennedy reporting to you from the internet for Wednesday, August 24th, 2005. And this would be Newsreel, your daily report as the woke counterculture defeats the evil of core political tyranny. Rand Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening, you are too. You can read all the news stories along with me, but just by going to my live journal. And you can get currently to my live journal by going to Sean_Kennedy.livejournal.com. This would be a free radio broadcast that can be heard on Rant Radio, Wild Bunch Radio, WNY Media Network, KJAG Radio, Radio306.com, OspreyRadio.info, and Extreme Radio Tampa, as well as SRN1. And you yourself are free to distribute this broadcast any way that you see fit. Got some feedback coming in. I got a lot of people all ticked off at me about a bunch of different things, so let's see if we can get through this feedback here. Hello again, Sean. It's not often I actually do two pieces of feedback from one person, but this particular one I'm going to make a bit of an exception. Well, I guess this email would fall into the feedback category. On Friday's broadcast of Newsreel, you covered three news stories in quick succession. Well, that's because I only have an hour and I have to go through everything in a quick succession, otherwise I won't get through the 12 to 14 news stories I do every single weekday. And I found three corresponding conclusions to be somewhat incompatible. I guess you could say at least they were coming from my own point of view. First, you covered the story about the Peaceaholics provided unpaid marketing for Rockstar Games. I don't know if they were doing that or whatever they were doing. If I was Jack Thompson, the lawyer in question, I would sink all my cash into Take-Two Interactive stops just to hedge my bets. In this story, you argued that people who worried about violence in video games should look at the bigger picture and realize that they're talking about a game when there's plenty of violence to fight in real life. I strongly agree with this conclusion. Sure. Second, you talked about the currency inflation in EQ2 due to a dupe bug. Your conclusion was people should, again, realize it's just a computer game and move on to more important real life issues. Okay. Third, you mentioned current research into 3D VR television supporting, in a sense, the senses of touch and smell. This you consider to be kind of interesting news, even though the research was not scheduled for completion until 15 years from now. That's because it's basically like a SimSense. That's almost like a cyberpunk immersion category. That's getting close to holodeck technology, and I think holodeck technology is pretty cool. Bully, Grand Theft Auto, and the likes are computer games. EQ2, by contrast, is a huge virtual world where the act and activities of living is reduced to simplify to appear game-like. Moreover, it is a virtual world that has real-life ties into finance. Those who make a living, even those who have a fortune selling virtual goods, or even brokering virtual currency. Wow. That's today, 2005. What role will these worlds play 15 years, if not sooner from now? When the 3D VR televisions become available, as a cyberpunk fan and reader of William Gibson's, Neal Stephenson, etc., surely you realize that cyberspace will not evolve out of the World Wide Web, but start out as a virtual world on top of the internet. These worlds already have semi-functional models of economic systems, e.g., freeform or game-limited means of object creation, and sometimes even city buildings, A Tale in the Desert, Shadow Man, Second Life, etc. They're all well-developed methods of communicating, sometimes more effective than our real-world alternatives like the telephone and instant messengers. Ah, the truth of this is becoming revealed to me. This is a person who is a hardcore webhead. It may seem largely inconsequential at this point in time that EQ2's currency took a dump, except for the fact that Sony probably lost a massive amount of subscribers and therefore a big chunk of revenue, which, considering that this hack may qualify as bringing down a core political news, but in the long run, this sort of news will be big enough to make the business section of any newspaper around the world. Just like it would if any nation with millions of inhabitants suddenly suffered an inflation of 20% by the act of a single individual, which has happened before, actually, using the stock market. Similar design flaws in virtual worlds of 2025 projected through your VR TV will be earth-shattering, much like the cyberpunk novels where the protagonists are the very substance of reality. It is, in my opinion, a thought worth mentioning. I believe your world that these worlds deserve more respect than they are just computer games. Comment. Well, there's lots of people. It goes on, you know, that's pretty much what he said. And that's well stated. He's saying that I'm just stating that these virtual worlds are only video games. And, you know, he's coming out saying, no, not just video games. Well, you know, if I cut the power off, they die. The video games in question are not real. All they are simply electronic pulses, okay? And we, because we connect our brains to it, this is why people are nodes of server, and without the nodes, there is no server. All the internet, I don't care how big it gets, is still just wires and numbers. That is, yeah, that is all it will ever be until you introduce biological matter to it. Until you introduce consciousness to the internet, it is not a world. What you have is you have rats in a maze. And the rats in the maze are able to manipulate and go around and do things based upon rules by the people who built the maze. Now, I can look at this from a cyberpunk angle and go, wow, yeah, you know, the VR is really cool, yada, yada, yada. But I've never really gotten onto the whole virtual world thing because I've never seen one built that I agreed with the politics or thought it was free enough for people to get behind. You know, there's lots of these games and stuff like that, but it's really escapist, and it's a method of farming the minds of people who don't want to deal with reality. Again, if you cut the power off, the world goes away. There is no, you know, there's money that transactions back and forth and affects the real world, so on and so forth. But let's just be real here. They are all just computer games. It is not reality. Okay, it does not, like, yes, you can make a little bit of money at it. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I'm sure there's people who make, you know, a good living at doing this type of activity where, you know, they trade goods and all the rest of it all in a virtual community. But what they're doing is they're making money then from a video game, which is okay. I have no problem with that. But let's not get too out of whack here. Until this thing can be self-sustaining, it's not its own world. I mean, it can be a controlled world, yada, yada, yada. But unless you can actually, like what I would rather have, and I've talked about virtual worlds before, I'm a big fan of virtual worlds. But I would want a virtual world to be set up so that, you know, it's, well, everyone has a stake. I don't like the idea of just random people logging in and making this, you know, you have to follow certain rules. I mean, I'm not really up on my whole virtual philosophy thing, and it's a very, very intense field. But what we're looking at right now is we're looking at Sony and all these companies farming, well, people. They're farming people to get them into escapist reality. And sometimes I wonder if that's unhealthy. So there's lots of people saying how fantastic these virtual worlds are, and I'm maybe the only one sitting back here saying, well, you know, hey guys, let's bear in mind this is a video game, okay? Come on now. You know, we don't need to give the radical right-wing psycho-Christian sect any more fuel than they really need to. There is fantasy and there is reality. And yes, although there can be money made from fantasy, just as I have donations because of Tales from the Afternow. But Tales from the Afternow is fiction, I hope. And if it is not fiction, then we are really, really screwed. So just, I'm trying to draw a line here between fantasy and reality. And sometimes online, that line gets a little bit blurry. Hey, Sean and Sim, when we met a while back in New York City, I live in the Northeast all my life, but I have a chance to work in the UK. It's about 45 minutes from London for about 1 year, and I'm very much thinking of doing this. It's a big chance, of course, and I've heard from people that this is the kind of opportunity you should not pass up. I have not worked out the details with the company, but they will be paying some or all of the housing costs while I'm over there. I am not married and have no children. Should I run off to the UK Gattaca State? Should I be concerned? What should I be concerned with before making this decision? Obviously, I've been paying attention to news stories you have done about the UK, but I don't want to let this scare me out of trying this. And that was from, I'm not actually going to say who that's from. Okay, so you're sending me this piece of mail, and this could actually be in the sort yourself out section, but I'm not going to bother because I'm going to try to convey to you how urgently important it is that you go to the UK, okay? You must go. You have to go. If you don't go, you're an idiot, okay? If this show in any way has any kind of bearing of your like, if I can, with 100% of my being, stand before you now, and if I could get on my hands and knees and beg you to go to the UK, I would. Please, please, please go over there, because when you travel, it can only help you. You should be doing everything you can to go. Who gives a shit what the adversity is? It will come whether or not you are ready for it. Sure, you want to watch your finances and stuff like that, but with an opportunity like this, absolutely, it can only improve your mind. And I will put it, I'll go one step further, and I will guess that this may be one of the most important things, if not the most important thing that you have ever done in your life. And if you think I'm over-exaggerating here, go. And 6 months after you're over there, you will write me and you will say, you were so right. Oh, God, you were so right. Because I've done this a million times where people have asked me this very question about foreign travel. And I plead with them. I beg them to travel. You must travel. And that goes for all the WOGs out there listening to this newscast. If you are, you know, in a bad situation and you don't know how to get out of it and you want to, you know, you feel like your life is going nowhere, go take a trip. Seriously, go backpacking. Go see the world. Get out while you can, while you're single, while you don't have kids, so that you can try to formulate an idea of what's really going on in the world. There's nothing worse than these pinheads that have got all the knowledge but no mileage. And those people really piss me off. If you haven't traveled anywhere and you haven't seen anything, well, then guess what? You don't know much. All you're getting is secondhand hearsay from books and whatnot. Don't get me wrong. Books are good, but you're still reading someone else's opinion. And you're basing it, albeit off of people you respect, even myself, I would encourage you to get your own experiences and make up your own mind. So please, please, for the love of God, get over there and do this. It could be the most important thing that you have ever done. And if you lived in the northeastern United States your entire life, I argue that it will be the most important thing you've ever done, especially in New York. I mean, New York is a funny city, man. I like New York, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't want to live there. But, like, people in New York, if you're, like, in Manhattan, you don't leave Manhattan. Like, you stay in Manhattan, you know what I mean? And New York is such a wild city. Like, you could drive a cruise ship through, you know, the streets of Manhattan, and people two blocks over wouldn't know about it because the city is so built up and huge. It's very, very important. Very important that any people who've lived all their lives in one region travel, even if it's just across America, even if you just travel around. I would highly recommend that, since we live in a continent where you can get into such a cultural diversity, even by, like, going down to South America, you know, go check out some of these countries we've got on our own continent. Europe's very expensive, but there's lots of stuff going on. We must travel in order to keep our minds open. Okay? Now, on to a sort yourself out section of the show. Dear Sean, I'm having a bit of a hard time. I fucked up in my 10th grade year and got sent to an alternative school at a local college where shortly after enrollment, I got kicked out. Wow. I moped about for a bit, then found a job at a fast food restaurant where I was fired after 3 weeks for being treated like a dog shit and having McEthics crammed down my throat. Now, six months since an unenrollment eligible for adult education and GED testing has rolled around, and I'm about to enter the adult education program, and hopefully, after I bone up on English and algebra, I will be ready to take the GED. If/when I have passed my GED, I want to take a welding technologies course at one of the local vocational schools, but I always have this sense of impending doom, as if my plans aren't good enough and I'm going to end up a worthless fuck sitting in his mom's basement. I feel the pressure to be productive constantly from my stepfather. It seems as if nothing I do is good enough to satisfy him. He's always fighting with my mom about how dirty the house is, even though it is clean. Not spotless, but far from Joe's apartment. I even tidy up after they leave every day just to keep them from freaking out, but it usually doesn't work. I've been washing dishes and towels and such to keep them off my back for not being productive. I really feel that I shouldn't be feeling this way at 17. I can't handle the pressure. I'm just trying to correct my fuck-ups, but I am being strangled by anxiety. Help me if you can. Well, this is kind of a bad scenario here. We got, you know, you're 17 years old, and you're thinking about taking some welding technology courses, yada, 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 and you want to know what I would say you should do. Well, it sounds to me like you don't got a lot of money. You know, I was in a similar situation in my life. Okay, I'll be honest with you. I barely got out of high school. True story. I mean, I graduated, woohoo! But I also, you know, just because of the way my life was, my life took a shit I was about 14, grade 10, failed a bunch of sciences, stuff like that. You know, you can make it through. And I got out of school because I took a lot of art courses. And that's how I made it out, you know, and from there, that's where I got my award in sculpture and creative writing and stuff like that. Now, although being an artist is pretty handy and you can make some money with that, it all depends on what you want out of life. You know, if you're looking at being a welder and you're thinking to yourself, well, you know, I don't really know if I want to be a welder, because what does a welder do? Well, you weld all day. You're going to probably get into a fabrication job. And it sounds to me like you want to have a little bit more exciting life than that. Now, your welding idea here sounds like a good idea, but it sounds like you're really unhappy at home. So, you know, when you're talking about drastic change, You know what I mean? You're talking about how can I do a drastic change to change my environment? Well, it sounds to me like you're going to have to grow the fuck up in a big hurry, my friend. And there's not much you can do about that. Now, I remember in my life, when I was working, you know, I was about, oh, how old was I? I didn't clue in as quickly as you did. It took me until about the age of around 24, 23, 21, somewhere in there, in my early 20s, before I was like, wow, man, I'm working at an assembly line job doing shit work for very little money, and I can't see any future in this whatsoever. I don't really know what I should do or how I should do it. Things are really, really difficult, you know, for what I want to do. Well, there are some options available to you, okay? You can either, you know, try to go to school and work shitty jobs and all the rest of it and try to make your living that way, and that's a very low risk for a possible reward, or you can do what I did, which a lot of people are going to be freaking out on me about this, but you might want to think about, you know, how you, what is it, you first of all, you got to determine what it is that you want to do, okay? Now, I don't know what you want, I don't know you, okay? I'm just going with what you've sent me here, and I noticed a certain correlation to my own life. Because I remember waking up one morning to a bunch of fleas drinking blood out of my arm. And I looked down at my arm and I said to myself, this has got to stop. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I sure as fuck am not going to stay in this house. And I got very Budo about that. And that was the reason why I decided, okay, to throw my entire life up in the air and try to go and join the French Foreign Legion, the British Army, the American Army, and eventually the Canadian Army. Okay, I tried to join four different militaries before the Canadians finally took me in. This was back, again, in 1990, between 1991 and 1993. Seems kind of funny, you know, because the French Foreign Legion's got a 15-minute sign-up time, and my eyeglasses just, you know, my vision was too bad. But I would state that, you know, maybe since you're 17, you're not really too sure what you want to do out of life. If you stay where you're at right now, if you keep doing what you've always done, you're going to keep getting what you've always gotten. Now, right now, it seems that there's this big war going on over in the Middle East. And if you were to sign up and join the military, you would be going to war, and you stand a very good chance of dying, okay? Well, not a good chance, but we'll say, well, what the hell? Let's give it a 50-50 odd shot that you die. Now, if you seem to think to yourself that, you know, what's preferable? You know, would you rather stay here and do the welding thing and suffer through this kind of crap every day, or would you rather get the fuck out and, you know, put yourself in harm's way? If you survive going to Iraq and doing that kind of stuff, or going to the sandbox, or going wherever the army sends you, and you come back in one piece, then, you know, maybe you'd make a career of it, a military of it. But even if you don't, you decide, wow, that was evil. You do 3 to 5 years, or however a minimum sign up is. You're only 22, and now, you know, you've got something on a resume that looks halfway decent. If you don't join as infantry, you join to get a trade. So you learn something, like, say, you go as, electronics or communications or something like that. You join up in communications. There's a lot of opportunity for people who've got experience working with satellites and stuff like that. I've oftentimes wondered that. People are always thinking that the Army, you join the Army and they just, you know, go and they set you up with the Marines and off you go and you go shoot people. There's a lot more to the Army than just being a Marine and shooting people. Not that that's important, because you need people who shoot people, otherwise there could be no war. But if there's like all kinds of electronics and communications and stuff like that, I've oftentimes wondered why people don't exploit that more. Now, that said, that's a total format and reinstall of your head when you're going in there. You're going to totally get rewired, but it sounds to me like you're pretty miserable with your life. And if now, a big thing with me, as everyone knows, is I'm not a fan of suicide. I don't like suicide. But the great thing about suicide is there's so many different ways to do it. You can either do it really, really slow by, like, smoking and living a life of quiet desperation until you finally just decide to give up and die. Or you can, you know, carpe diem and all that good stuff, try to seize the day and get out there and take on the world. And there'll be all kinds of people who will tell you, no, that's wrong, don't do this, this is stupid, I can't believe you'd even think of such a thing, you're insane, and they will still be there when you get back from wherever it is you have gone to. So what am I telling you to do here? Well, you know what, you've got a choice, and the choice seems to me that you're looking to either, what are you going to do? Are you either going to stay at home in a situation that you're obviously miserable about, you don't like being here, you don't like your aspects of the future, or are you looking for something else that could come along? Now, there's other organizations as well. There's the Peace Corps. You know, there's the Red Cross. There's, I don't know if you're a Christian, you haven't talked about your spiritual values in this letter. Maybe you might want to look at doing some mission work, but that involves you going to Africa, which I'm a little bit nervous about too. But bear in mind, you know, there's a good chance you go to Iraq. So because there is so much, you know, stuff going on in the world right now, maybe, you know, you may wish to look at working for a company because you're doing crap work anyway, right? I mean, making fries at McDonald's is crap work. I don't care what anybody says. Those people bust their ass. So if that's crap work and you want to do don't want to do crap work and you'd like to get maybe a little bit of experience and something that looks better on a resume than just a fast food job while you're waiting to be a welder, you know what I'm saying? You could join the Army, travel around the world, probably get yourself bombshelled or wounded somehow. But if that doesn't happen, you might get yourself a trade. It's a bit of a trade-off there. But if I was in your position at your age, I would have to say I would be casting my eye towards a military tasking. That is just me, though. And I'm sure I'm going to be getting the phone book of people to bitch me out for telling you what I honestly think. But that's my call. And, you know, I mean, if you want to get a second opinion, which I highly advise, before you do this, make sure you talk to a war vet. Talk to people who have been in. Go down to the base and talk to some of the soldiers already in there. Get some guidance. Because a lot of soldiers, especially in a trade you're thinking about, say, yeah, I'd like to be a Marine. Go talk to some Marines who've been someplace. Go talk to some sergeants and say, listen, man, I'm thinking about joining the Army. Here's my situation. What would be the best course of action? And I'm here to tell you, there are some senior NCOs who will lay out a plan for you in about 20 seconds that'll blow your mind. So, you know, give it some thought, but that is an option for you. All right? Just an option. Don't take my word for it. Definitely do your own research, but don't get it online. Okay? Don't be listening to a bunch of asshats from the left and the right screaming at you. Make sure you go talk to people. You live in the United States. Okay? You've got a lot of opportunities open to you to go around and check out what's going on. All right? Now, in oil surf news, and this was sent to me by No Delete, this is kind of a scary story coming out of China. Now, this is the problem I have with some of the communist stuff that's going on. I don't know. This is a bizarre story. I know that I wouldn't be down with this. Former employees of a state-run oil field in North China are jumping through a strange hoop to get their jobs back. They're filing for divorce. China's state-run giants, once the heart of the planned economy, have cast off millions of employees since the launch of the market reforms 2 decades ago. But the Huaibei oilfield company, based in Ringgu, Hebei province, Friday, and issued a new policy saying divorced laid-off employees could return to work. The Chinese news website, www.sinai.com/CN, said Wednesday, citing an article by the local Yanzhou Metropolitan News. Very strange. Following these rules, laid-off employees just have to have a divorce certificate and they're qualified for re-employment. A former oilfield worker, Wang Ying, was quoted as saying, well, I wonder what would stop them from just going to get the divorce and then go get married again. To qualify to get my job back, I had to divorce my husband of 10 years, even though we have a wonderful relationship. But again, so you're living together in the same house, so you had to do some paperwork, right? So, I mean, it's kind of a bizarre thing here. Divorce is on the rise in China, but still unusual outside of big cities. State media reported 1.6 million couples from the country of 1.3 billion people divorced in 2004. And that's not that many, really. I mean, is that a lot? I don't think so. I think that's less than 1 in 10, pretty much. Anyway, but among the Hubei employees, untying the knot became so common that people had replaced the standard greeting of have you eaten with are you divorced yet, the report said. Around 20 couples connected to the oil field, a subsidiary of CNPC, China's largest oil and gas producer, have formally split on Monday alone. An official from the local marriage registry bureau was quoted as saying, wow. The report did not explain the oil field's motives for the pro-divorce policy. The company management was not immediately available for comment. So it seems like, yeah, if you're willing to divorce your wife, you get to come back to work. Well, I would go out on a limb and take a guess as to why they want them to divorce their wives. And that's because workers who are divorced don't have any life outside of the company, and therefore they will work harder and longer with no relationship to, kind of slow them down or make them miss. Now, in gunplay news, this is a strange story sent to me by Red Hot Ice. Very, very weird. I can't believe this, but apparently New Orleans, which I think is the basis of that movie I saw the other night, Skeleton Key, which just as a quick film review here, anyone who wanted to see Skeleton Key, I saw that. I didn't have to pay for it. That's why I go see these movies, because I don't have to pay for it, because I think it's ridiculous to have to pay, like, you know, $15 to go see a movie. But anyway, I went and seen that Skeleton Key movie. It's a good movie. It's all right, you know, on the horror scale and stuff like that. My wife liked it. I was kind of around the 5 mark. I mean, I couldn't really tell you why I didn't like it. You know, it just didn't seem to grab me. Maybe I was on a funny night, you know, maybe whatever. So if I was into it and I just couldn't seem to get into the movie. Now, the movie, probably, if anybody else ever judged it, would probably get a 7 out of 10. But I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10 because it wasn't really all that great, but it wasn't really all that bad. It was just kind of like there, you know. It was like the chicken of horror movies. You know, everything tastes like it. You know, it's a horror movie, blah, blah, blah. And personally, for the record, I think the young girl could have taken her and she shouldn't have run away. I think she should have just turned and fought. But that's just me. Anyway, back to New Orleans. The murder rates have fallen dramatically in many major U.S. cities, but that's not happening in the Big Easy, hence New Orleans. Although the murder rate in New Orleans is lower than it was a decade ago, it's rising and is nearly 10 times the national average. Wow, so New Orleans is like, wow, don't go there. A criminologist said the city's trend is reverse of the 46 of the top 50 cities in the United States. Experts say the trend in the city's that's home population to the French Quarter exists for several reasons. The trend in the city's in the city. Oh, sorry. Experts said that the trend in the city that's home to the popular French Quarter exists for several reasons. One, there's too many drugs, too few police, inexperienced prosecutors, and residents staying quiet because they fear retaliation, which is pretty common. I mean, for the French Quarter in New Orleans, yeah, a lot of people would do that. They did an experiment last year by a university researcher, which police, now check this out, this is a scary experiment to do in a major city. The police fired 700 blank rounds, okay? 700 rounds, like, that's a lot of fire, okay? In a New Orleans neighborhood in a single afternoon, so they hammered off 700 rounds. That's like a war zone gunfight, okay? And no one in the neighborhood called the police to report gunfire. That is insane. To have that little, like, wow, those people must be living in fear or something. But I guess that's what life is like in New Orleans. Now, in virtual reality news, sent in by Skyburst, a man has been arrested in Japan on suspicion of carrying out virtual mugging spree by using bots to beat up and rob characters in the online computer game Lineage 2. The stolen virtual possessions were then exchanged for real cash. So he logs onto a computer, types a bunch of code, manages to create sort of a, he takes virtual items away from people and then exchanges them for real money. The Chinese exchange student was arrested by police in the Kanagawa Prefecture, southern Japan, the Manchai Daily News reports. Several players had their characters beaten up and robbed of valuable objects, valuable virtual objects, which could have included the Earring of Wisdom or the Shield of Nightmare. These items were then fenced through a Japanese auction website, according to NCSoft, which makes Lineage 2. The assailant was a character controlled by a software bot rather than a human player, making it unbeatable. Ren Reynolds, a UK-based computer games consultant and editor of the gaming research site Terra Nova, says the case highlights the problems of bots in virtual worlds. By performing tasks within a game repetitively or quickly, bots can easily outplay human-controlled characters, giving unscrupulous players an unfair advantage. Yeah, but it's pretty similar to real life. I mean, that happens in real life all the time. You get bots replacing people all the time. Many games firms employ countermeasures to detect this bot activity. For example, they can ask a character questions or present him with an unfamiliar situation and monitor their response. So you wind up with, you know, a Turing test for your bot. There's an ongoing war between people who make bots and game companies, he told New Scientist, and making real money out of a virtual world is getting bigger. Now, this is very interesting because let me finish this off. Furthermore, the line between virtual and real cash has already disappeared. In the game EverQuest, for example, lets players buy and sell virtual items and characters for real money through an authorized online trading site where they take part of the cash. Reynolds says the growing number of online game players will increase the incentive for scammers. There's nothing exceptional about the virtual world, he says. Wherever there is that sort of money, there will always be crime too. Now, the thing is, the guy built himself a robot in a virtual world, right? This is a virtual world. This illustrates my point about virtual reality here. A guy built a robot in a virtual world that was an attack droid. He built an attack droid that went out and robbed people, okay? Attacked, preyed on other members of the virtual society, okay? So he established a predator-prey relationship for the virtual society. Look at that. And, of course, everyone's going, that's wrong. He shouldn't be able to do that. Right. So what do they do to control it? They apply force, and they apply force in the real world against the person who's doing it in the virtual world. okay? But I would argue that rather than arresting him in the real world, why don't you, since it's a virtual crime, the man, all the man has done is set at a computer. Okay, now this could be also accused with hacking, but he didn't hack a real bank. He went into a virtual world and took people's virtual possessions and then sold the virtual possessions. So again, it's all done within the game. What I would say would be a better idea here, it'd be to, well, just simply destroy the bot. You see what I mean? Like, it seems kind of weird when you start blurring that line there, you know? I mean, did he really do anything wrong, quote-unquote? Did he hurt anybody? You see what I mean? Is this a crime? Well, he's robbing me with this bot. No, the bot comes up and fights you, and you're not good enough to beat the bot. Therefore, the bot wins, and he takes your cash. I don't know if I'd really call this a crime. I might call it unethical. I might say he's a prick. But I don't know if I'd really call it a crime. And it does, you know, show the need for other players to be able to defend their virtual characters. That's why you get virtual combat and all that sort of jazz. This is merely the reality of the real world spilling over into a virtual game, you know, and now they're trying to control it, and this is a very effective way to control that rather than having your game. I don't know what Lineage 2 is based on. I don't know if it's a science fiction game or a fantasy game or what, but it's a very, very interesting sort of thing, because what if people start doing that in real life? You know, I mean, what would they do? I mean, we're already replacing workers with robots. We're trying to replace soldiers with robots, and we don't seem to think it's too unethical for the people we're using the workers or soldier robots against, right? You see what I mean? It's a very interesting concept there. I'd like to get some feedback on that. Newsreel, that's my email address, newsreel@rantradio.com. Now, in more freaky China news, China's really showing up a lot in the news lately, eh? Kind of makes me a little bit concerned, because I've been saying for a while now that I think China and Russia are going to ally, and that's why America's funding India to try to get, you know, the Indian army all up to speed. But we don't hear much about that in the news anymore. But I think that the big war is going to come down the pipe between India, China, and Russia. Now, if I was India, if I was the United States, here's something I would be really concerned about, is making sure that India doesn't jump sides. Because if I was India, I'd be like, yeah, sure, let's arm up ourselves with all this American tech and know-how, and then we just go to China and say, hey, guess what? Let's go kill all, you know, the Western people, because generally they're evil and bad anyway. So whatever, blah. So what if India, China, and Russia all form an alliance? We have got a very serious problem there, okay? Especially if they decide that they're going to come across and kick our ass. Like apparently China's Minister of Defense is saying. Now this is coming off a pretty white right-wing website, but here, check this out. Apparently Qi Huntang, I guess is the dude's name, Chinese Minister of Defense and Vice Chairman of China's Central Military Commission, gave the following speech to his military leadership. Now there's a complete copy of the speech on the website, apparently, okay? He spoke openly about China's need for more living space, which they do. They got like a billion people over here. And stated bluntly that the United States, Canada, and Australia are the only places large enough to accommodate future Chinese needs. Wow. He notes the need for quick, effective biological attack upon the United States to depopulate its prelude to conquest, and it plainly states that China is working on genetic bioweapons to kill everyone except for, quote-unquote, yellow people. Holy crap! In his chilling remarks, boast a recent survey of the Chinese public wherein upwards of 80% were willing to shoot and kill women, children, and prisoners of war as part of such an effort. Okay? 80%. Now, this is all coming from the Chinese government. I don't think Chinese people are really this vicious, but that's okay. More frightening was his admission of an ongoing deliberate deception of the United States, with China portraying itself as a peaceful business partner while actually planning to kill 1 to 200 million Americans, end quote. He also notes that thanks to trade, income from Chinese exports is providing the financing needed to vastly expand the Chinese military might in preparation for the attack upon the United States, which seems to indicate will occur within the next 5 to 10 years. Now, aside from the fact that, you know, all this kind of adds up a little bit, you know, I could see it makes sense for China to say this. I mean, you know, from a completely cold-blooded standpoint, they do need the space. You know, and there's no better way to, you know, get rid of, you know, all these unwanted people in these lands you want to occupy than to use bioweapons on them. You know, it'd be kind of funny that they cross the ocean and do that, considering, well, the white people crossed the ocean and did that to all the Indians to start with, and now the Chinese are going to come over here and do the same thing to us. which is not really pleasant for me. I'm not too keen on that because I think everybody has the right to defend themselves and all the rest of it. Now, when you look at that go and you go, I think the Chinese are not really thinking too clearly on this, and they overestimate their ability, because if they think they're going to be able to invade and hold ground in the United States, like, they're going to, China's setting itself up for its very own, you know, Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq. If you invaded the United States and tried to hold ground, you'd have to kill every single American out there. Actually, that's not true. You'd have to kill every single right-wing American out there, because all the left-wing Americans would probably side with China, which is unfortunate, but it's pretty true. I mean, you know, when you look at the communist mentality, there's a lot of communists who think that, you know, the way China's doing things, I mean, they are going to the moon. There's a certain, kind of logic to how the Chinese country works. I mean, they have 1 billion people living there. They're pretty strong. They have a really strong economy. Maybe they've got it right. You know, maybe that's what's going to eventually, that's what's going to cause the fall of America, is China's just going to walk in here and destroy it. They'd stand a chance of doing that, but of course America would do the Captain Kirk thing and start throwing nukes around, and that's very, very concerning for me. So this is probably a story with this kind of logic that I'd want to watch to be very sure. Now, in Desert War news, this is very important, from Escarta, the Army is planning for the possibility of keeping the current number of soldiers in Iraq, well over 100,000, for 4 more years, the Army's top general said Saturday. In an Associated Press interview, General Peter Shoemaker of the Army is prepared for the worst case in terms of the required level of troops in Iraq. He said the number could be adjusted lower if called for by slowing the force rotation and shortening tours for soldiers. Interesting. So they're going to take it down to the 6-month mark, which is what it was in Vietnam. Incidentally, in Vietnam, it was 1 year for your non-coms, and officers only had to do 6 months, which I always thought that was a little funny, that officers had to do 6 months because their life isn't as strenuous as the non-com. But anyway, Shoemaker said the commanders in Iraq and others who are in the chain of command will decide how many troops will be needed in the next year and beyond. His responsibility is to provide them trained and equipped. About 138,000 U.S. troops, including 25,000 Marines, are now in Iraq. We are now into 07 and 09 in our planning, Shoemaker said, having completed work on the set of combat and support units that will be rotated into Iraq over the coming year for the 12-month tours of duty. Shoemaker's comments come amid indications from the Bush administration officials and commanders in Iraq that the size of U.S. force may be scaled back next year if certain conditions are achieved. Among those conditions, an Iraq constitution must be drafted in the coming days, it must be approved by a national referendum, and elections must be held for a new government under that charter, which sounds simple enough, but is a pretty complicated thing to have happen in Iraq. Shoemaker, who spoke aboard an Army jet on the trip back to Washington from Kansas City, I guess that's Missouri, made no predictions about the pace of political progress in Iraq, but said that he was confident the Army could provide the current number of forces to fight the insurgency for many more years. The 2007-9 rotation he's planning would go beyond President Bush's term in office, which ends in January 2009. Shoemaker was in Kansas City for a dinner Friday hosted by the Military Order of World Wars, a veterans organization. We are staying 18 months to 2 years ahead of ourselves, and in planning, active duty National Guards and reserve units will be provided to meet the commander's needs, Shoemaker said in the interview. So it seems like we're not getting out of Iraq anytime soon. Nothing new there. And even if we did, you can bank that we're going to be trying to keep our super base there in Saudi Arabia. Why? One reason only, oil. Oil, oil, oil. It's all about the oil. Why is it all about the oil? Because America will grind to a halt without oil. And so long as we remain dependent upon oil, we will kill and die for oil. That is what this is about. So we can either say, this is terrible, and it is terrible. Don't ever kid yourself. People dying in a war is terrible, terrible, terrible. But without the oil, our culture slams to a halt. Imagine for a second that the oil stopped flowing. Okay? Just imagine that. The oil stops. Well, our entire country is 3 meals away from anarchy. I'm going to go beyond the country. I'm going to say the entire freaking continent is 3 meals away from total anarchy. The Canadians stand a good chance. We Canadians up here, because we still live in a fairly, you know, rural environment. We got trees and we can hunt and stuff like that. And there's enough, you know, bushmen and trappers and stuff like that up here that we could probably, you know, make a go of it. But in the United States, if New York had no oil, holy crap, dude, we're talking about hundreds and millions of deaths. I mean, just in a very short power. I mean, my God, We're talking about a crisis to likes of which the United States has never seen. So I can kind of understand why they're fighting for oil. It's obvious that they're fighting for oil. You need to, you know, if you want to get the complete history on this, make sure you go slap and you go to Torrent Spy, do a search for a documentary called The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. And that will nail down the Middle East for you in a nutshell in about an hour, okay? Now in conviction news, this was sent to me by Vavrick over there on the little island. Candles were lit all across America last week in the largest single anti-war protest in recent U.S. history. More than 1,600 vigils, tens of thousands of protesters gathered in solidarity with the woman who has been a catalyst for the rebirth of the anti-war movement, Cindy Sheehan. Her remarkable one-woman stand outside of George Bush's Texas ranch has turned into a national phenomenon and one of the most vicious political slanging matches in recent U.S. history. On the pro-war side, Sheehan has been derided as a traitor to America, betraying her dead soldier's son's memory. On the anti-war side, she's become a secular saint, laden with the powerful imagery of the avenging mother roused into action. For them, she is a lone soccer bomb who is taking on Bush and winning. Either way, Sheehan is the most talked about woman in American politics. She might also be Bush's worst public relations nightmare. For months, Washington has been awash in speculation of a tipping point when the majority of the American public opinion turns finally and permanently against the war. Many now believe that Sheehan has provided that final push. It definitely has tipped now, said Professor Steve Zunes, a political scientist in the University of San Francisco. This is great. You know, this is really good. I'm not going to take a side here because everybody knows that I don't think America should be in Iraq. I think they should be, you know, pulling out, take all this money they're blowing there because it's big money, right? It's about money and money to oil companies and things like that. With the intel I have, I believe it would be more prudent to take all of our forces out of Iraq, okay, with all the money we're blowing on this war, dump just maybe, I don't know, a fifth of that cash into research, into a new fuel source, give tax breaks to automakers and things like that so that, you know, it encourage that sort of, you know, direction. The thing is that the automakers and the people who are funding the war, the people who, you know, want the war to exist, are not tied to America. You see, there's lots of cars to be sold in China. There's lots of cars to be sold in India. So, you know, if these multinational corporations that started in America wind up leaving America as a third world country and skip over to China and India and Russia as their economic boom happens, well, so be it, because they're not tied to any sort of loyalty, and that's why this war will keep going. Now, I do have a question, though, which is something, you know, a lot of people aren't going to like, but let's say, you know, Cindy Sheehan here gets shot. Okay? Let's just say she's out there protesting one day and bang, thud, she gets taken out. That's it. Nobody knows where it comes from. It's a shooter. Maybe somebody gets blamed for it. Maybe they never catch the guy, but she just catches a bullet. Is there any kind of, you know, possible, you know, so what? What would happen then? Nothing. Not a thing. People would be upset. There'd be a lot of hubbub, and then they'd move right along. You see? That's one of the problems with being a lone protester, is once you're removed and causing huge problems, there's a lot of people getting behind her saying, rah, 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 anti-war in Iraq, anti-war in Iraq. But the thing is that there's no power there. It doesn't matter if 8 million people get behind her. There's still no power there because all the government does is say, well, that's nice. Oh, well, so what? Because they've rigged up the black box voting system, so public opinion doesn't mean anything. If anything, the last election should have told you that. There was never as much anti-Bush propaganda or anti-presidential propaganda as there was prior to the last election. Michael Moore made a full feature-length film decrying how stupid George Bush was. Everybody saw it. And yet still the guy got into office. This is why I believe the balloting polls are fixed. Okay, so once you realize that they've got the voting system all sewn up, it doesn't matter how much you protest. That's why the chick is still out there protesting, because she doesn't have any power. You can light all the candles you want. It's not going to make the lick of difference. Now, in Iraqi TV news, sent in by Alien Binary, it's Cops Iraqi style, minus the Bad Boys soundtrack, but otherwise roughly modeled after an American TV show. Now, I've heard of this. They're playing this over in Iraq. Created to make the government more transparent, the cop show featuring Kirkuk officers, which is, I guess, their name of the police force there, in action, is the first of its kind in the country, is breaking new ground in Iraqi television. A live call-in portion gives the public the chance to praise the security forces or gripe about them. I'd like to see how many people are griping. Screened weekly on Kirkuk Television, which broadcasts in this northern city nearly 1 million people, the cop show has opened the floodgates in a community long suppressed. During Saddam Hussein's time, it was very difficult, station manager Nasser Hassan Mohammed said. You were unable to ask questions. You couldn't say anything bad about the police. Now people can call in directly. Anyone has the right to do this. The difference is that this is the difference now. This is freedom, which, you know, I guess there cannot be argued. That's what's happening. The call-in portion, initially a novelty, has become a staple of the show, and panelists field up to 30 calls per segment, Mohammed said. And because Kirkuk is ethnically mixed, the show switches among the languages spoken by Kurds, Arabs, Turkmen, and Assyrians. Now, this is great because, if nothing else, it does give, again, Kurds, Arabs, Turkmen, and Assyrians a common forum. It gives them an ability to speak out, and that is very, very important to have. In any kind of a situation, you have to have communication. If you don't have communication, the only way you're going to be able to make the bullets stop is with words, but you have to make sure that you get communication going amongst the warring sides and warring factions. Now, again, you know, there's those that would argue, fuck it, let's just pull out of there and leave the whole place into a mess. Well, they made the mess. It would be bad of us to pull out and leave the mess there. But, I mean, you know, it's kind of like we're in a big damned if you don't scenario. If it was me, I'd just simply leave and call it a day. You know, sorry, guess it didn't work. Da-da. But that'll never happen because of the oil. Now, on to some cloning news. And this is kind of neat. I got to admit, this is kind of neat. I still want to see what happened to that Tyrannosaurus Rex soft tissue they pulled in because, you know, I want a T-Rex. In cloning news, sent to me by Foulware, a conservation institution in the United States has produced wildcat kittens by crossbreeding cloned adults. The Audubon, I guess that's what it's called, Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species says that this is the first time that clones of a wild species have been bred. 8 kittens have been born in 2 litters over the last month and apparently are all doing well. We'll have to see what happens with these kittens, of course. The researchers say this development holds enormous potential for preserving a range of endangered species, which is cool. I mean, it's always good to keep, you know, animals that we basically murdered alive. The litters were born to separate mothers but share a father. On the 26th of July, a female called Madge bore 5 kittens, which was followed by 2 August by 3 kittens born to Catty. Madge and Catty are both clones of further females. Of a further female, Nancy. So they're cloning all these animals. The father of all 8 kittens is Ditto, cloned from Jazz. So we're breeding clones here. Very interesting. It'd be interesting to see that they're doing this with cats as well, because a cat is a pretty, you know, neurologically complex creature. By improving the cloning process and encouraging clone animals to breed and make babies, we can revive the genes of individuals that might not be reproductively viable otherwise. We can save genes from animals in the wild, commented Dr. Bessie Dretzer, who led the scientific team in the Auburn Center in New Orleans. Again, I want the T-Rex. The center has been working with the African wildcat, Felis libya, for several years, producing kittens in in vitro fertilization. And in 1999, and the first clones showed up in 2003. Now, I never even heard about these wildcats getting cloned, but I guess it wasn't a big deal. The animals are somewhat larger than typical domestic house cats and may have domestic-style tabby coat. Although not endangered, they're a useful model organism for developing techniques which researchers hope one day could be used to help preserve species at risk of extinction. So what we're doing here is we're doing more experiments in cloning, and it'd be interesting to see where they go with that. It would also be interesting to see what's going to happen in the bioweapons division, because in Russia, you know, when you think that bioweapons may be a new idea, but not so. In Russia, there was a place called the Red Star Kennels, which tried to create a combat dog that would be the ultimate Russian war dog, and they came up with a thing called the Black Russian Wirehair Terrier. If you do some searching online, you'll find out about these dogs. They're amazing dogs, by the way. But I would wonder what would happen if Americans gave a try to something like that using cloning technology and started with, say, oh, I don't know, an American bulldog, crossed it with a Borbal, and then probably a lion, which it could be argued that lions and Borbals have a lot in common to start with. And in transparent bag news sent in by Dark Nature, and this is kind of just a bizarre story, which I find offensive. I don't particularly care for this because, you know what, I don't like people having to see through my stuff, but, you know, whatever. You know, you make up your own mind here. A range of see-through rucksacks and cases have been launched for tube users in an attempt to reduce fear in the wake of the London bomb attacks. The Freedom Bags, they're called, which are made out of clear vinyl, are being sold on the internet by the Assistant Safety Project, a private nonprofit organization. The company hopes that seeing the bag's contents will assure commuters that it does not contain explosives. I mean, the level of terror must be pretty high over there. Whatever happened again to business as usual? Hello? It plans to donate any profits made in the London bombings to the London Bombings Relief Fund. Now, London has been bombed a long time, and when they were getting bombed, really were getting bombed every day, what was their policy but business as usual? By doing things like this, you're letting the terrorists win. Bob Fitzjohn, and John Fitzbob, director of the Assistant Safety Project, said the company wants to give the public back the confidence needed to travel in the underground London Underground again. So I bet you these guys are making good money on this, though, through, you know, operating at a deficit and paying themselves a salary, and hence their nonprofit, and it all looks very, very up and up. If we all carry a bag that poses no threat whilst traveling, on a public transport, we're visiting a football or rugby match, or just at a department store, we're giving the message that we're prepared to let others know that we're not a threat. Now, what would be interesting to do, actually, is if I was one of these guys, I'd buy one of these bags, and you notice that the back, of course, is probably going to be solid. It's not going to be vinyl. But if there's ever any part of the bag that is solid, you could put like a false pocket in there to put, you know, your actual private stuff in there, like documents or maybe money and stuff like that, so you don't make yourself such a target to thieves and things of that nature. Sometimes, he says, the perception of danger can be more frightening than the danger itself. And truer words are not often said. Now, this last story is rather long, so I'm just going to touch over, but apparently there was a rave held in Salt Lake City, Utah. And what happened is that there was about 700 tickets were pre-sold. They expected up to 3,000 people to show up. And then what happened is that during the show, the cops and the National Guard showed up and started tear gassing, and all with assault rifles and masks and full shock armor, and broke up this rave. Now, the rave was 100% legal. They had a $2 million insurance policy. They had licensed security guards. The police did not have a warrant, okay? And if you watch the video, it's quite apparent that they've got helicopters, assault rifles, tear gas, camouflage, you know, combat fatigues, shock armor, and all of this peaceful gathering. Very, very bizarre. And if you read the account, he goes on and really, this guy's totally pissed off about the whole thing, and perhaps he has a point. But, the amount of force that was used to dispel this rave, that was, why was it done? Why was the rave broken up? Was there a complaint and somebody, the cops just decided to break this up? What was the reason for sending in the sharp end of the soldiers? Why were soldiers sent in? Why weren't police sent in? This is really, I draw your attention to the film. If you have not seen the film Under Siege it might be just called Siege. It's with... it's not the one with, I'm having a total brain fart. The guy who was in, he did Manchurian Candidate, too. The remake of Manchurian Candidate, he did a show called Siege, and Bruce Willis and that guy was in it. But anyway, that's a very good film to watch because you don't use the military for an action like this. This is ridiculous to use the army for this with dogs and everything. For a legally peaceful rave, it seems to me that somebody somewhere should be getting sued through the floor for this, but I bet you they're not going to be able to do that because of the Homeland Security Act. I bet you dollars to donuts, but definitely we need to take a look at that to realize just what is happening in America. Today's daily hack is some hidden Windows applications, thanks to Notably. Be sure to check that out. And that's all I have for you today, but don't worry, I will be back tomorrow to make sure you get all the information you need to stay alive. This is a free radio broadcast brought to you by the generous donations of those willing to fight in a time of crisis. And there's 76 people for the month of July, 71 donators for July with 5 new people who had shown up. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help keep this daily news broadcast on the air, please visit rantmedia.ca. And thanks again to everyone and their assistance in gathering data. If you have access to sensitive information or any other pertinent stories, please email them to Newsreel. That's Newsreel at rantradio.com. If you like the music in the background, be sure to pick up the album by Bad Religion called No Control. I'm going to leave you now with a track by Pal 3 called In My Head. It's on the Matrix soundtrack, one of my favorites. So until tomorrow, that's what Server said. End of line.